3 years ago, the country marked the 60th anniversary of the U.S. Supreme Court decision in Brown versus Board of Education. That was the case that made forced segregation of schools illegal. You'd think more than six decades later that schools would be very different, and yet they're not. By many measures, schools with poorer and darker-skinned students provide poorer educations. And the segregation itself persists. It's rare to find a true mixing of skin colors in any school or district. Nolee Ray Rooks examines the many factors that lead to separate and clearly unequal school systems in her book, Cutting School, Privatization, Segregation, and the End of Public Education. Nolee Ray Rooks lives in Ithaca, New York, and teaches at Cornell University, where she's the Director of American Studies. Before that, she spent a decade as the Associate Director of the African American Studies Program at Princeton. Her previous books include White Money, Black Power. Nolee Ray Rooks, thanks for joining us today in The Exchange.
Thank you so much for having me.
It sounds like education is very much in your DNA. Tell us about the teachers in your family.
Yeah, so my on both sides of my family, I've had educators of different kinds. My grandparents, my paternal grandparents, grew up in a family that were farmers. They were sharecroppers. They had some land. And that's how they supported themselves. Once education kind of opened up, they both went from a farming rural background, went to college, got educated. My grandfather was the principal of the only black school in Clearwater, Florida that educated everyone from elementary up till high school. And my grandmother became the special education reading teacher, so she was known for that. My mother's side of the family is a little bit different. Her background was also rural. They also grew up in Texas. They grew up in Texarkana, Texas. But her parents did not actually get much past fifth or sixth grade education. But my mother went to San Francisco State and was instrumental in putting together a number of tutoring programs in inner city San Francisco.
Wow, so that's a lot of education pedigree in your family.
School.
Yeah, your grandfather, the principal, tried to integrate the teachers union in Florida. What was the response to that?
Yeah. So after being a principal for so long, one of the things, I don't know how much your listeners know about the history of sort of unions and integration, but at the time, in the 1950s, unions were heavily segregated. So there were white unions, white teachers' unions, and then there were black teachers' unions, but they weren't recognized by the state. So there were more sort of like black support systems. So in order to really make sure that you could get paid, be equalized, and hours, and have some job protection, so that you weren't just at the mercy of anyone who might want to fire you, he really tried to work hard to integrate the teachers' unions in Florida and to allow them to accept black members. Over the period of time, this was a 10-year effort. I grew up hearing the stories about the numbers of times that he was shot at by different white supporters of segregation, people who were not interested in seeing that kind of integration take place in Clearwater, Florida, or in the state of Florida. There were firebombs thrown through the window. His life was threatened. The teachers he worked with, their lives were threatened. My grandmother's life, his son's life, all around just, trying to have black people be seen as worthy of integrating a teachers union, the teachers there. He was ultimately successful, but, it was not without quite a bit of trauma.
No, and I ask about the story because people did work very hard to end segregation in the union and the schools themselves, and yet you say what we have now in the public schools is apartheid.
Yes, we have apartheid schools. I mean, most of the large urban areas or rural areas, what you see is schools, or actually in suburbs as well, you see schools that are overwhelmingly segregated by either race and or economics. So wealthy students tend to go to school with other wealthy students. Black students in urban areas and cities like New York City, for example, or Chicago, Philadelphia, Washington, D.C., the schools, 60 to 80% of the schools are almost 100% of one race or one economic group. So in ways that we don't really notice, I think that because we're so used to being around people who are like us in various ways. That could be people who are of the same class background. It could be people of the same racial background. I think one of the things that I've been thinking about is how is it that so few of us look around these kinds of common spaces and don't notice that we are segregated. But right now the country is said to be, the studies that people have done say, you know, the country is as segregated today as it was in 1964, 10 years after Brown v. Board of Education.
In all facets of society or just in education?
Well, it's mostly education. Housing is a close second. When you look around, I mean, part of the reason that we see so much segregation with public schools, with traditional public schools, really does have to do in large part with housing patterns. We tend to like to live with people who look like us and are at the same class that we are. What that means is that neighborhood schools then also end up being highly segregated. But the issue is, you know, that's one thing, but in trying to solve that one thing, the issue is that the things that, while we, most of us support, if you ask parents, white, black, Asian, across race, across economics, if you ask people if they support integrated schools or, you know, they think that segregated schools are best, we do not tend to think segregated schools are best, and we do support the idea of public education, of integrated schools. We just don't like the ways, the things we have to do to get there.
Okay, so we'll talk about what those things are as we continue our discussion with Noliwe Rooks from Cornell University, the director of American Studies there. Her book is called Cutting School, Privatization, Segregation, and the End of Public Education. And there's no as we know it, it's just the end of public education. We'll get into the more of the specifics about what's gone wrong in Noliwe's estimation and what can go right. Join us on The Exchange by phone or by email. We'll be back in a minute 15. Back on the Jefferson Exchange on the News and Information Service of Jefferson Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Our guest today is Noliwe Rooks from Cornell University. She has written a book about education and the fact that it still remains segregated by fact, not just by supposition. And it is not legal for segregation to be enforced anymore, but still there we are, separating ourselves into different skin colors in our school systems. Noliwe Rooks writes about this in her book, Cutting School, Privatization, Segregation, and the End of Public Education. You can join the conversation on The Exchange, 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. There are plenty of us, Noliwe, who can remember the time when integration was done through busing. You, in fact, yourself were bused in Florida, weren't you?
Yeah, I was. It's interesting. Like it was, I started to write this book when I recognized that I was a part of the first group of students in Clearwater, Florida, to be bused out to the county. That was in the early 70s. Florida was one of the last southern states to actually take seriously trying to get schools integrated. And what that meant in Florida, different states took different routes, but in Florida what that meant was taking black students, putting them on buses, putting us on buses, and busing us out to the county, which is about a 30-minute bus ride. So we left very early in the morning and got back very late at night. But it was interesting is that I hadn't actually remembered that until I started to write this book. And so I started to think about, so what trauma did I experience? You know, the stories that we have about integrating schools, black students, the first group of black students to integrate predominantly white schools or all white schools, you know, there's always a trauma associated with it. And I, in my case, what I came to realize is I was perfectly tolerated, but that I had no friends. Like the childhood memories that you have from high school, mm-hmm. I'm sure many of your listeners, or from elementary school, I was in the fourth grade at the time. You know, sleepovers, birthday parties, little cliques, giggling, sitting together at the lunchroom, those kinds of things. None of that happened for me. I had no birthday parties, no sleepovers, no friends, no significant attachments or relationships from that period. I did learn how to square dance, which I take as an accomplishment. And I can still recite all 52 prepositions by memory from that period of time. But But yeah, but I was, it, you know, I do have some sense of what it meant to have one or two black faces in predominantly white classrooms. And as we face integration, as we talk about integration today, but for many people, depending on race, now here's where there are some real differences. White families tend to take one or two faces who are not white as integration. It's integration enough. So what wealthy white families in particular mean when they say integration is if there's 20 kids and you have two black and one Latino, that's good. For black and Latino parents, very often you're talking about almost 50-50.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that's part of what trips us up is when we mean very different things even when we say integration.
Oh, even our definitions are different then. Wow, that's pretty interesting. So busing itself, though, this is an interesting factoid that you pulled up in the book that I didn't realize that it was a federal maneuver that really stopped busing from going on anymore.
Yeah, in the North and the South, but, you know, very often when we think about school integration, we really only focus on the South, the former slaveholding South, but there was quite a bit of resistance. I'm sure many can't remember, like in Boston, right? Like that was a sort of epicenter where the idea of taking children and putting them on buses, this is taking white children, putting them on buses, or black children, anybody going on buses to integrate schools for folks in Boston was a problem. But buses themselves, you had the Ku Klux Klan were busy bombing buses with children on them, with children not on them in cities like Detroit. But the federal government also got involved, and really, it had never been the case that it was illegal to integrate schools. So in the South, the big difference was that state legislatures all over the South, following Reconstruction, made it illegal to educate black and white students in the same classroom. And so when integration was made the law of the land, the first thing that had to really be attacked was that idea that it is, you know, now it has to be legal. You have to come up with ways of integrating. In the North, it had never been the law that black and white students couldn't go to school together. But what had happened by the 1970s, late 1960s, 70s, is you had whites moving out to the suburbs in big numbers. So starting in the 50s with planned communities, and you know, you had whole tracts that had been urban of different groups of whites who moved away from the cities. So when it came to integration, it really did mean by 1970 that you had to bus the black students out to the suburbs if that was going to be the method to achieve integration. And you got the federal government in response to their constituents, you know, really saying that this was not something that they were in support of, did things. Joe Biden, for example, our former Vice President Joe Biden, sponsored a bill that forbid using federal dollars to buy gasoline for buses if the buses were going to be used to integrate schools.
Wow.
So there were all manner of ways that people really tried to figure out, well, so it's not illegal for us to be together, but what ways can we make it very, very difficult, if not impossible, to achieve integration?
Now, Leeway Rooks writes about segregation in schools that continues to this day. Her book is called Cutting School, Privatization, Segregation, and the End of Public Education. So I'm glad you bring up Joe Biden, because when he was vice president, his boss, Barack Obama, got a letter from a middle school student in Dillon, South Carolina. What was she writing about?
Yeah, Tashioma. She wrote at the time about her time in middle school. She's writing about her little town in South Carolina and the state of the school that she was attending, which sat by some railroad tracks. And so six times a day as the trains went by, they were so close to the railroad tracks that instruction had to stop. There was mold all through the school. The sewage backed up regularly. They didn't have heat. And so she wrote to him and said, you know, she was just so thrilled that he was president. Of course, you know, as soon after the first State of the Union address is when he introduces the country to her, his first State of the Union address in 2009. And she says, you know, but the rest of us here at this school, we want to be doctors and lawyers and maybe even presidents, and we don't think that we can do it in a school that is quite this broken down, that doesn't have heat, where all of these external factors are making it impossible for us to learn in this school. So he brought her, you know, she and her mother, to the first State of the Union address, and they got hearty applause, and he announced then that he was starting a stimulus effort that would make it possible to redo, to renovate up to 1,200 schools throughout the country to address just this issue that she had pointed out. So it was a day for the young woman, you know, never been out of South Carolina before. And, you know, she said it was just something in her life to when, that the president just knew who she was, and then that she, you know, was able to become the face of this sort of revitalization. So a couple years later, she attended the ribbon cutting for the brand new school. It was sparkling. It was gorgeous. You know, away from railroad tracks, and there was no mold anywhere. No animals running around inside the school. But the point that I make in the book, though, is it what it really showed, given the amount of money that went into this school revitalization and school rebuilding effort, that ended up being almost a complete failure, a very expensive failure, probably one of the most expensive federal failures in terms of investment in education, because it focused just on the infrastructure. But it did almost nothing to promote the kinds of strategies like integration that we actually know, you know, yield the kind of results that are necessary for a young woman born into a struggling family in a struggling region to become president or an engineer or a doctor or a lawyer.
So Taishioma Bethay and her schoolmates got a new building, but nothing changed within the walls of it, it sounds like.
Nothing changed. The literacy rates, you know, a few years later, the State Department of Education, you know, talked about almost three quarters of the students in the whole state, including in her district, were considered illiterate. But this is a district that is made up overwhelmingly of students who are below federal set poverty levels and high levels of racial. They're not very many white students in these particular schools. So it really points up how it's not just like you'll sometimes hear, you know, we just want to equalize resources for students. There's more. We have so many examples of people, and I think that I have no reason to believe that President Obama was not trying to do a good thing. And it was certainly the case that these schools needed to be rebuilt. There was no question. But there's a difference between just saying you need a nice building and you need a quality education. And so far, when it comes to students who are of color and who are of the lower socioeconomic levels, we're failing at providing a quality education.
And that is the topic of Noliwe Rook's book, Cutting School, Privatization, Segregation, and the End of Public Education. You can join the conversation on The Exchange. Lots to talk about here. 800-838-3760 to join in by phone, by email. It's jx@jeffnet.org. So by the numbers, Noliwe, when schools are truly integrated, how much better do students of color do? How much better do all students do?
Well, so this is the thing about integrated schools, and we know from all kinds of research, it's not just that let's try to help, you know, struggling students. All students do better. White students benefit. Wealthy students benefit because you're giving people the opportunity to really stretch beyond the everyday, stretch beyond what they're comfortable with, learn to interact and learn different parts of our psyches and different modes of empathy. And so the growth for students of color and poor students, far more really helps to close. There was a short period of time in this country where we really did have widespread integration, where we did from say 64 to about 1980, which is relatively short for in the life of this country, you know, where integration was actually working. And the thing is, we saw higher rates of graduation from high schools. We saw test scores start to narrow. We saw a black middle class that started to grow and go into different kinds of areas than we had seen before. And we saw a lessening of some of the the discord, the civil discord that has reared its head yet again in the country, that as well went down. So in all manner of ways, is this the reason that every time there's a court case that talks about integration, I mean, I think that we should pay some attention to the fact that institutions like the military is always on the side of more integration and saying that, you know, it makes our nation start, like, consistently. You have the generals who come forward and say it just makes our nation stronger, and that they cannot have a military that does not have people who are coming to them from integrated spaces. In the top Fortune 500 companies are always on the front line saying we need workers who are coming to us from integrated schools. So when you have, you know, business and the military and the law mandating that something should be happening, you know, we really do have to take a good hard look at ourselves, I think, to try to figure out why there's so many of us that resist it so vigorously.
And you mentioned that the period of more integration than we have now, and it was roughly 1964 to 1980. In the book, you track the concerns of the business community over schools to about that time, the Reagan years.
Mm-hmm.
So do you think the motives are pure? I mean, in the sense that they just really want to have better educated people who work better together?
Well, I mean, so what happened, starting with Nixon, up through the Obama administration, but certainly right there in the 1970s and that decade to the early 80s, the business community the business community along with legislators started with a report called A Nation at Risk that came up with this this line that resonated with everywhere, that basically said we have spent so much time on social engineering our schools. We spent so much time thinking about putting money into things having to do with, like, civics and social justice kinds of issues. What's happened is America as a whole, the whole educational system has started falling farther and farther behind. And they said, you know, things are so bad, our test scores are so poor, that if this kind of famous line that if a nation power had undertaken these kinds of activities against us, we would consider it an act of war. I'm totally paraphrasing. So what they said is now we need to just focus on what's best for America's business. Like, part of the issue is we have all these kids who are graduating and we can't find the workers that we need. And so we need to stop with all of the social justice stuff, stop with all the integration, and really just focus on changing the ways that we are thinking about education, and now to see it as creating a workforce in particular. And there's almost 300 reports that get authored between the early 70s and the mid 80s that are all a version, you know, of the same kind of analysis. Business, you hear it today, you know, that we need more tech in school because the tech industry is really the growth industry, and so forget all the other stuff. Today we're not talking about social justice as much as, so forget music, forget art, forget, you know, anything that's not really going to laser-like focus us on kind of tech schools. Well, then there were just different concerns that they had. The thing that I point out and consistently say, though, while that makes sense, like all of these different narratives around education and why we're separate and why we should stay separate, make intuitive sense in some ways. Like, yes, of course, some part of education has to do with employment. But what I point out and always ask is, but then why is it that the children of the wealthy, the children of the folks who bring us technology, are not advocating for these same kinds of absences in their children's schools? The private schools, the upper middle class, high achieving schools that wealthy kids go to, and overwhelmingly white kids when they're wealthy go to, have lots of music and humanities and study Greek, study Latin, like things that are not necessarily going to laser-like lead you into the workforce. So why is it okay to educate the wealthy in certain kinds of ways? And why do we so often say, but we're educating everyone else to be a worker, and they should not have access as a result to the same kinds of educational strategies?
Is it a specifically vocational, technical kind of education, or is it just that we're making, this is what everybody should do now, we should just get better workers? I mean, because what you're saying is you're going from what was a well-rounded person who's just sort of smart in a lot of areas to somebody who knows how to do the jobs that the economy's creating.
Yeah, so it depends. In places like, say, Chicago, Mayor Rahm Emanuel has just come out with a new set of rules saying that really when people graduate from high school, they will not be awarded a high school degree unless they can either show that they're going into college or that they can get gainful employment. You can't just sort of, and you have to show that before you can get out. You can't just plan to go to college or just plan to get a job. Before you will be awarded the high school degree, you have to go in one of these two directions. And so in all kinds of ways, as you see more of a focus on coding, you know, everyone wants people in poor communities to learn how to code to the exclusion of everything else. And so that's the problem, that it's just narrowing down what we need to know in order to funnel people, certain populations, into a workforce.
All right, making more worker bees in essence. The book is called Cutting School, Privatization, Segregation, and the End of Public Education. Noliwe Rooks wrote it and is our guest on The Exchange. We'll come back in a minute five. Final segment on today's Jefferson Exchange. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. We're having a deep discussion about education in America and how segregated it still is. Now, 63 years after the Brown versus Board of Education decision, we still have de facto segregation. And in fact, it's a bit worse than it was a couple of decades ago. Noliwe Rooks from Cornell University, where she's the Director of American Studies, straightens things out in her book, Cutting School, Privatization, Segregation, and the End of Public Education. You can join the conversation on The Exchange, 800-838-3760 by phone. Our email address is jx@jeffnet.org. Let's take a call here from Rick in Ashland. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Noliwe Rooks.
Yes, my name is Rick, and I'm a substitute teacher in this area in Oregon. And I have two questions for you. One, separation of church and state. Last week I had an assignment where half of my class went out for an hour for Bible study, and I was shocked, and yet it gave me a lot better chance to work with the remaining students. Second question, what effects have you seen regarding Betsy DeVos, our current National Education Secretary, and her moves towards privatization? Thank you.
All right. Thanks for that, Rick. Appreciate that. So why don't we start with Betsy DeVos, because that's certainly the current affair.
Yeah. So Betsy DeVos is, of course, a big supporter of getting rid of what she terms government schools. And the way that she says it, you know, it almost sounds like a dirty word. Like they are schools that are, you know, funding comes from the federal government, but only about 10% comes from the federal government. What is happening in schools for the most part is controlled in the funding, as well as some curricular interventions have to do with a state-to-state. Things are very, very different across the country, one state to the next. But the religious schools and homeschooling are actually some of the fastest growing areas in education in the United States. The concern is that once you make things quite so ideological, once it becomes, you know, we want to include with church separation of church and state, when you decide that you want to include church schools in education funding at the same kinds of levels as traditional public schools, what we've seen, like talking about how over the past 30-something years, as we've seen different efforts to try this, generally it increases racial and economic segregation as middle-class white parents often put their kids into religious schools. Other students are left behind in schools that even more money has been taken out of. So these are some of the ideas that are our current Secretary of Education, Betsy DeVos, supports. And I think that it's why her tenure so far is there's a vocal vocal discussion going on about what people think about some of her ideas for education writ large.
Indeed, there is. And to Rick's other point about kids leaving for Bible study, that sounds similar to the kids who left for catechism when I was in elementary school.
Really? Did you go to Catholic school?
I didn't. I went to public school in Long Island.
Wow. I have never heard that.
Yeah, the kids were an hour late, like every Tuesday or Wednesday, to come back from catechism.
Wow. Yeah, that's news to me. I went to Catholic school for a minute. So, you know, that was a part of my educational background, but it was not, like, I've not been in an educational setting that actually, in a public school, you know, had children going to catechism.
Well, it was outside the school grounds.
Or Bible study.
Yeah, it was outside the school grounds in that case. I'm not sure what Rick is talking about in Ashland, but it has happened before. They can be dismissed for some sort of religious instruction, but I'm curious that it takes time out of their class time.
Right, exactly, yeah.
So let's talk about because one of the subtitles of the book is about privatization and the end of public education as you see it, and you point out that there are people who can make a profit off of creating lousy schools have done so, really.
I think that's one of the big points or one of the big things that I ended up that I came to understand doing the research for the book, and that I began the research for the book really just trying to understand segregation today, why I was seeing so many of my students at the time I was at Princeton University, and there were so many really wealthy, really privileged students who had gone to either high-performing public schools or private schools who all of a sudden really wanted to talk about education in urban areas and poor areas and rural areas and saying that, you know, your zip code shouldn't control what school you go to and education should be a right. And so I initially was trying to just understand that moment, you know, what has led to this kind of outpouring of interest by this group that, you know, very often had never even been to an inner city area, didn't know any like poor people, like they decided to help. And one of the consistent themes that I started to notice was how often these same students were then going into businesses following graduation that had something to do with the business of education. And I had never thought about the business of education before. I had only thought about it in terms of public money and public schools. But at the time, you had entities like Teach for America, which was very popular with Princeton students. And what Teach for America did and does, is provide teachers very often to struggling school districts. Not many of their teachers are going to high-performing, wealthy school districts. Most of them are going to either poor rural areas, poor urban areas, areas that are overwhelmingly of color. And what I didn't really recognize is that, they get a finder's fee for each teacher that they provide. So between grants, state funding, local monies, and these finder's fees, Teach for America is worth $400 million. It's grown to a company of that size, but a lot of it has to do with providing teachers to certain kinds of communities. So I started to notice how many businesses students were going into that were saying that what they were trying to do was close achievement gaps. A lot of the early charter schools, the KIPP academies, which is a charter school chain that does very well. They get very high-flying test results. They're one of the top sort of charter chains in the country. But the chain, because they're a private company that has access to public dollars, but they're a private company, the chain is worth hundreds of millions of dollars, and the founders are very wealthy people as a result of this. But we haven't seen interventions like that, those privatized interventions around how to educate children, how to teach poor children and children of color. We haven't seen it actually make a huge dent in the gaps that we have, but we have seen it fatten particular pockets. So that's one of the things that I kind of discovered that goes along with all of this intense engagement with education and educational forms is these same kids were then going into businesses and profiting from these highly segregated schools.
Teach for America is technically nonprofit, though, right?
It is a nonprofit, but so is Princeton. But, you know, you can be a nonprofit. The NFL is a nonprofit. Like, you know, the idea of a nonprofit, sometimes we think that means that you are in business not to make money. That's not the case. So while it is a nonprofit, that has to do with its tax status, mm-hmm. but the company is actually worth $400 million.
It is one of the largest 100 charities on the Forbes list. You also mentioned the Edison Project in here. Here's an interesting example, too. Tell us about that.
Yeah, the Edison Project. Chris Whittle in the late 80s, early 90s, decided he's the founder of the Edison Project, and he said he wanted to come up with an educational system that in the same way that when Thomas Edison decided he was going to create the light bulb, he didn't just do something different with candles. You know, he came up with a whole other form. So part of the pitch that Whittle made with the Edison Project was to go into urban districts, to poor districts, struggling districts that were being defunded, that were struggling to figure out how you educate people with fewer dollars. And he said, you know, I'll do it for you. I'll take over the management of the schools. I'll bring my own curriculum. I will, expand as large as you want me to. And if you just turn it over to me, I will handle it. The big intervention he made was saying, and I'm going to go I want to be publicly traded. I want to have this also be listed on the New York Stock Exchange, and to begin to turn it into that kind of business, like a hedge fund, where you're talking about big money. And so it was listed on the stock exchange, and it was high-flying for quite a while. Of course, what ended up happening is, as he was not able actually to deliver over years, like so you had years of students who were failed by their educational systems when they were working with him, but over years, you know, it became clear all the test scores were bad, everything was falling apart, people weren't showing up, the money, there was overages. So while it was the darling of Wall Street for about 5 years, getting as high, I think it was like $12 a share when it first came on, got up as high as $38 a share. But as more and more people really weren't doing very well in these schools, you know, it went down and down and down and got so low it was threatened to be delisted. But in that period of time, Chris Whittle and the company really did show that there was profit to be made from public education.
And Naliwa, you propose to penalize those who try or do profit from educational inequality. How would you do that?
Yeah, you know, I think that I was just reading something recently that was pointing out that until like the late 70s, it was illegal in the United States to profit from health care. You had to be like a nonprofit, not if you were a doctor, like you'd be a doctor or whatever, but that you could not profit, like you couldn't be putting people in jail and people couldn't be going forced into bankruptcy. And as a way of trying to keep preying upon sick people at bay. And, you know, when you think about education, you're talking about the most vulnerable people. And a lot of part of what I talk about in the book is how many different forms of fraud and graft are enacted in the name of helping certain communities. So hundreds of millions of dollars a year are lost to the expansion of different kinds of charter schools, and there's specific chains that are profiting from this. The 20% of charter schools that are doing a better job than the public schools, you know, I have no problems with at all. You know, if in fact you're doing what you say you're going to do, that's one thing. But the 70% of charter schools that are doing worse or no better, then putting all of that money into that that form of education then seems to me to be a complete waste. And then you look more deeply and find that people are taking trips to Europe. They're, you know, buying chain stores like Victoria's Secrets. You know, they're franchising and using. This is all taxpayer money that's supposed to be educating kids. But it's going into private pockets and only really aiding their bottom lines. That kind of egregious, like I call it theft. I believe that it is theft. I do think that we should say is just not legal. Like you can't do it. It's not illegal now. I mean, when you get caught just straight stealing, yes. But there's all kinds of ways that people are shifting money into their pockets. They're renting out their own home and saying, "But my home is now a business because it's, you know, got a charter school in the basement, and I'm going to charge the taxpayers what, you know, someone at the highest real estate levels would charge. You have things like that. Like those things, I really do believe we could use some state oversight or federal oversight to say, you know, we're watching and it matters what you're doing with our money.
So ultimately then, Naliwe, how do you get the kind of system you're talking about, though, where you have people of different wealth in the classroom, and people of different skin color in the classroom together, learning together, where they all do well together?
Well, so what I say is if I had the easy answer to that, really, I would totally leave Cornell and hang out a shingle somewhere. But I what I do say is all of the money that has gone in from Bill Gates deciding that we need a whole new system, a common core system of testing, has been hundreds of millions of dollars. Walmart Corporation is investing hundreds of millions of dollars in charter schools. I already said TFA is, you know, over the last 20 years has become a $400 million company. What I'm asking is, but what if all of these folks, all of these people who say that they're interested in education, and the education for the least of these, for those who need it the most, what if they put their money together and actually tried strategies that we know work instead of these idiosyncratic strategies that at least arguably, they either do not work or arguably are inconsistent in their efforts? And if as much time and energy and influence and lobbying was brought to bear on fixing that problem, the integration problem, the lack of desire for us to integrate, I think we'd be farther along.
Wow. So finally, what happened to Taishioma Bethea and her plans for college?
Yeah, Taishioma ended up in 2014, which is the last trace I've been able to find of her. She was working in a convenience store in Atlanta. She never was able to go to college. She just didn't have the money for it. So while she did a great service to the people in the community in terms of they have a nice, beautiful building, she herself was not able to become an engineer or a doctor or a lawyer.
Well, the book is called Cutting School. Naliwe Rooks wrote it. Thanks for joining us today on the Jefferson Exchange.